danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 143 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Montreal, Quebec, Canada, it's Andrew Brokus. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be in Montreal. I'm happy to be playing the World Championship of Online Poker. I'm happy that I'm actually slightly ahead right now on my trip, which is quite rare for a trip that's dedicated to playing large field multi-table tournaments. I'm actually slightly in the black at the moment. Not after you consider costs, but not counting costs, I'm slightly in the black.
That's fantastic. Well, I mean, a trip to Montreal in September is that's worth it anyway. So
just being here has been lovely.
Yeah, usually the psychological benefit of traveling to play only tournaments is that there's like no expectation that you're going to get your money back. So like it's like freedom from even desiring it. So that's good. If anything, it's sort of bad for you that now you have some more chance of breaking even. It's just yeah.
I'm really having a nice time out here. I mean, as you mentioned, like Montreal in September, the weather is really lovely. It was actually kind of on the humid side when I first got here, but then I got here on Thursday night, and on Sunday there was like a torrential downpour that night, and then like the next morning the sun was out again, but all the humidity had been kind of, it was like a little bit cooler, and it's just been, you know, really, really perfect weather since then. I had a really easy time getting into the country. Like, of all the times I've come to Canada to play poker, and this is maybe like the 7th or 8th time that I've crossed the border now. This was by far the easiest. You know, the last time when I went to Vancouver, ultimately I got in without an issue, and they told me that I had done everything right. But they actually, you know, they kept me in the immigration office for about 20 minutes and just sort of like went into another room with my passport. And I don't know what they were, what precisely they were doing, but you know, they came back and they said that they'd had issues with people coming to Vancouver to play poker and then like staying longer than they said they were going to, or staying longer than they were supposed to, or just sort of like, you know, coming as a visitor and then just staying indefinitely. But they, you know, they said that they looked at my travel history to Canada, which is obviously on my passport, and you saw that I had a history of like coming and leaving for 2 to 3 weeks at a time, which is exactly what I did on that trip. So ultimately they did let me in, but obviously it's a bit stressful sitting there like,
sure,
just, you know, knowing that they're, you know, currently debating whether you're going to be allowed in, and if they don't let you in, I didn't think the chances, even once I reached that point where they're debating it, I still didn't think it was likely that I was not going to be allowed in, but you don't really have anything else to think about.
Sure.
So it was nice this time. I mean, I just, I do think in general, Montreal has been a little bit more chill about it. They probably have fewer people coming over, but the guard sort of asked me a couple of questions, and he was just, you know, kind of trying to determine why I was coming to Montreal by myself for 2 weeks. And I usually don't, you know, I just kind of answer their questions honestly, but I don't volunteer a lot of information. So he's just like, you know, so you're coming by yourself? Yes. You have nobody with you? No. 15 days, Montreal, all by yourself? Yes. Do you know anybody in Montreal? Well, I mean, I do, but that's not like why I'm coming. He's like, why are you coming? I said, I'm here to play the World Championship of Online Poker. And he kind of like raised his eyebrows, you know, like he's like, okay, well, good luck. Pass, sent me along.
Very good. Did you get the hello, bonjour at the beginning of the interaction?
Yes, of course. Hello, bonjour.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts about French Canada.
Yeah, it's rare. I mean, as much as technically it is a bilingual country and you do see a lot of stuff translated into French in other parts of Canada, you don't see a lot of stuff translated into English in Montreal.
Yep, that's... Yeah, that's right.
But fortunately, my French is good enough that I can usually communicate what I want to communicate, and I can certainly understand, you know, signs and that sort of thing. I generally have difficulty understanding questions that are posed to me, but I haven't had a lot of cause to need to talk to people in French since I've been here. I have had an interaction with a Montrealer. I had brunch yesterday with recent podcast guest Alex Weldon,
the
game designer. Yeah. He seemed good. We had a nice, actually, it was, I mean, I played the, I guess we're recording this on September 23rd.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is Wednesday, and I'll talk a bit more about what I played in a second. But yesterday I was playing the 2K Super Tuesday event that started at 2 p.m., so I had a little more time than usual in the morning. And they have a really good bike share program here in Montreal, so I was able to get a bike. And just another example of how nice it is in Montreal, I rode my bike to go and meet him near where he lives at a breakfast place that he recommended. And just the ride was kind of like, first it's through the plateau, which is sort of this kind of old residential neighborhood in Montreal, which I find very charming and has kind of a unique style of house that you really don't see anywhere else. So kind of ride through there first, and then you ride through downtown and along the what's called the Old Port, right along the water. There's like a bike path there, and then the bike path kind of goes through an old, like, I guess it's not really an old industrial area, it was built a long time ago, but it's still, you know, operating mills and things. And so you kind of wind your way through that stuff, and then you ride along a canal for a while, and then eventually I got to where I was meeting him. So it was a very nice bike ride in the morning, and then of course I had a nice meal with Alex, and then we went to a market afterwards, and I got some ingredients to make some meals for myself, and then I came back and I played the 2K and I cashed the 2K. So yeah, he got my day started off right.
High five. Good. I have a non-poker update.
Yeah.
I'm reading All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy, and it's awesome. And I'm kicking myself for not having read everything Cormac McCarthy has ever written, and it's rocking my world. So if you don't see me online much, it's because I'm reading Cormac McCarthy.
I haven't read that one. I really liked The Road, and then a bunch of people were recommending Blood Meridian. There was actually some discussion on 2+2 of some debate as to whether or not that was like the best American novel ever. I found it a little hard to get into. I mean, I thought the prose was good, but I really enjoyed The Road. I don't even actually know what All the Pretty Horses is about.
I guess it's the first one in the quote unquote Border trilogy, and it's about a dude who's really good with horses who travels from Texas to Mexico to work with horses forever. And then he meets some horses and a girl and some various other characters, and then things happen.
I assume very violent things happen.
Some of them
based,
not.
Based on what I know about Cormac.
Some violent, some just, you know, charming, some interesting, all richly described and very moving. So that's my book recommendation of the week. I've had a lot more time, not only for poker, but for reading, and of everything that I've been reading lately. I would even put All the Pretty Horses above at least most, if not all, the Knausgård volumes, which I'm a very great fan of. So
now I might have to check it out.
Yeah, highly recommended. Highly recommended. It was very lucky. I just went to the library and sort of scanned until I saw a book that looked interesting that I hadn't read before, and the selection was a little bit sparse, but they had this. So there we go.
Well, we do not have a guest this week, so apologies for that, but we will have an opportunity to talk a little bit of WKIP stuff. I grabbed a hand or two that I think we can talk about. I know, Nate, you have a hand that was sent to us from PL08, which people always enjoy, the non-Hold'em games.
That's right. I've got a PL08 hand came across my desk, and I have some things to say about it. So,
although, actually, even before we get to that, I wonder if we could... Well, I guess first off, I should tell people that, as always, our strategy segment is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. And of course, given that I am playing the World Championship of Online Poker right now, you can expect some WKOOP related material from me, and I'm sure from some of the other pros showing up pretty soon on Tournament Poker Edge. In order to get access to that, you'll need to sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com, and I suggest you go and do that.
Fantastic. And now, what were you going to say before?
I was going to say, I had a listener email that I wanted to address as well, but let's start with your PL08, and then we'll do that, and then we'll see how much time we have left for WKOOP things.
Good. So this is, first of all, a shout out to everybody who's been writing in and telling us what they like or don't like about the show and what they want from us, and a lot of people say they like the non-Hold'em content. I'm sure there's also... Sorry?
I said I do.
Yeah. I imagine there's like a silent majority, or possibly, you know, super majority, who really just care about Hold'em, but, you know, But we care about other games, and a lot of people out there have written in and said that they wanted more non-Hold'em content, and thank you for writing in and telling us so. We appreciate it. So,
and for sending us non-Hold'em hands we can actually discuss.
Yes.
I don't play that much non-Hold'em games myself, so if you want to hear the non-Hold'em content, you might have to send it to us.
Yeah. So this one came across my desk. It is a PLO 8 hand. It is 2/4, and it's four-handed, so already it's slightly interesting. So our hero is in the cutoff, which is also under the gun, and has ace jack 10-7 suited to the ace. The ace and the 10 are suited, and he opens for $12. And this is pretty uncontroversial, I think, and my correspondent thinks so also. And but I do think that some people underrate this hand. I would open this hand from a lot of positions. I would also 3-bet this hand a fair amount, both because it's good and because it has some high potential. It has some nut potential, but also it covers a lot of boards. So very often, if there's a low possible, you'll have at least an emergency low. And when there's not a low possible, you're going to have a high. You're going to hit a lot of the high boards. There just aren't going to be too many boards that you miss with this hand. So both sort of in itself and as it adds to your range, it's good to have both a hand that hits a lot of boards and a hand that, when added to the rest of your range, makes your range hit a lot of boards. It's something we talk about in Hold'em sometimes, and it's also important in 08. So you're going to have a lot of hands that don't like jack 10 flops or like, you know, queen 9 flops and flops like that, either because they have no high at all or they just have one lonely overpair when, say, you're raising from early middle position. And it's great to smooth out your range with this hand, which is also a very good hand on its own. So that is my short discourse on ace jack 10-7 single suited to the ace. Do you disagree with anything I've said?
I don't feel qualified to disagree with anything you say. Yeah. I don't know that it would be as obvious to me. I imagine I would open it. I don't know that it would be so obvious to me that it was like definitely the correct play to open it. Probably I would be like, I'll open this and I'll ask Nate later about whether I should open this. But I like to think I would have raised as well.
Yeah, I should say, I mean, I'm not like a world expert in PLO8 by any means, but I've thought about the game a lot, and what I've been doing in the games I've played has been working. I also think it, like, 3-betting it out of position against an opponent who's really going to make life hard for you, that could get you into trouble. But a lot of opponents skew a little bit too passive after the flop. And against those opponents, especially because you have such good flop ability with this hand, 3-betting it even out of position and then keeping the heat up afterward is going to work out well for you, I think. So good. Strong hand. Our hero opens from the cutoff, and it gets to the big blind, who calls. So we're taking this flop heads up. Again, it's 2/4 PLO8. The hero's playing $240. The big blind is playing about $200. So effective stacks are about 50 big blinds. So the flop comes king, queen, 8 rainbow. So we flop a straight draw. I would call it a wrap. It's not the best kind of wrap because the ace is at one end of the deck, but any ace jack 10 or 9 gives a straight, so that's good. That's 13 outs. It's a good straight draw. It's even better because the board is rainbow, and king queen 8 sometimes doesn't hit many of the hands that the big blind might be defending. The big blind checks. Would you bet here?
Yes. I think I probably bet the flop too often in Omaha games. I think that you kind of have that tendency. I mean, I'm probably betting the flop too often in Hold'em as well, but I think you don't get punished for it as much in Hold'em, which is, you know, part of why people for a long time were able to get away with even having like 100% continuation bet ranges in Hold'em. I think often like the difference between betting and checking, if you were the preflop raiser and you're just called by the blind, the difference between betting and checking in Hold'em is not huge. So even in cases where checking is better, you don't really get punished that much for betting too often. I think that I probably, you know, have carried over some bad habits into my Omaha play where I'm a little too willing to bet the flop when I have hands that might play better as a check. Is there a backdoor flush draw here?
There's no backdoor flush draw.
Okay, so that would make me actually a little more tempted to bet the flop just because I can imagine a lot of turn cards. Although it is a good flop for Hero, I can imagine a lot of turn cards that where, I mean, I suppose you can really call a bet on just about any turn. I guess if the king or queen pairs, it could get a little more dicey. But in general, I imagine you can call a bet. Like, even if it's a low card, you're still going to have most likely some sort of low draw. If it's an ace, you'll have a straight, even though you won't have a low draw. So I guess like your hand is generally going to be good enough to call a turn bet regardless. I think having a backdoor flush draw would make your hand even more resilient.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think betting here is pretty clear, but it might be worth going through why. So we don't have a hand yet, but we do have a very strong draw. If we get raised, I think we can happily 3-bet. I think some hands, maybe not many, but some will check raise fold. And even if they don't check raise fold, we have 13 outs. And
isn't check raising boards like this kind of a thing in Omaha? Like if people, I mean, obviously there's some weighting towards playing small cards in PL08,
yeah.
So that if, when there's not a low draw on the board, isn't that a time when people, you know, at least for exploitative reasons, might say, hey, maybe I should have a check raise bluffing range here?
Yeah, I think there is. I can't really speak to the games on Bovada. My correspondent seemed to think that the players were a little less sophisticated and more just played the value of their hands. But I do think in some more, I mean, like Angela Jordison probably would knows when to go to war and when not to. I think, again, it's sort of like the early days of Hold'em where you had people, you know, fighting back on boards where it was obvious to fight back against a preflop 3-better on. And I think we're still in the early stages of that adjustment and counter-adjustment game. I do think that some people have probably started not c-betting too much on these boards as the preflop raiser for fear that they're going to get raised. I would imagine in a 2-4 game on Bovada that a lot of raises will be for perceived value, which is not to say that they won't fold to a 3-bet. Like a hand like Queen-8 could raise fold. But I do think that... yeah, you're going to get some raise folds, which makes the bet 3-bet even better. So
yeah, I mean, I think just as kind of as a general poker point, if you have a hand that's good enough to 3-bet when raised, yeah. It's a pretty good reason to bet the hand. And like that, it's a pretty good sign that you have a betting hand. And if you're not betting it, it should, I would say, generally be more because you're slow playing it than yeah. because you're kind of checking it cautiously, which is, I think, what we would be doing here if we were to check this hand. It wouldn't be, like, obviously it's not such a strong hand that we're trying to, like, sucker our opponent in. So I think, you know, given that it is a good enough hand to stand up to a raise, and in fact a good enough hand to 3-bet to a raise, I suppose that's a pretty good argument for betting it in and of itself.
Yeah, that's right. And even when we fold out, like, ace-3... XX, you know, folding out that better backdoor low draw has some value, and folding out like a naked queen or an eight is pretty good for us too. So
yeah, I mean, I guess the upside of like people don't play that many high card boards is that, you know, you also get to do more kind of semi bluffing on those. Like you probably will have a decent amount of fold equity here, and even though it's probably going to be relatively low equity hands that are folding, you know, they're not hands where you gain anything by letting them see the next card either.
Yeah, that's right. Good. So we bet. Get called, and the turn pairs the eight. So again, we have ace jack 10-7. We raised from the cutoff and got called by the big blind, and who checked and called a half pot bet on a king queen 8 flop. Turn pairs the eight, puts up a flush draw also, and our hero has only the 7 of the suit. So there's about $50 in the pot, 50 to 55 after rake. And there's about 175 behind in the effective stacks. And the big blind checks. And here our hero decides to make another half pot bet. And I think that's a good play. So I think Hero's range has plenty of full houses. With Hero's actual hand, he wants to win the pot immediately. I think he's probably, against a lot of players, only going to get raised when he has no equity. And sometimes when he gets called, he's going to have some of those 13 outs being alive, and he gets to play the river in position when he's just called. So I thought this was a good spot to bet, and I think that this is a spot that people will miss. They'll either, as Gareth might say, you know, they'll play, am I going to make a straight instead of poker? And especially in Omaha, it's often considered like a sucker move to bet, to play for a straight, quote unquote, play for something when the board is paired. And of course, it is a sucker move to radically overvalue a straight when there's a paired board. But I think this is a good bluffing spot. I think a small point is that the cards that Hero holds do block some of the eights and full houses that the big blind could have. So I think this is a less obvious bet than the flop bet, but I think it's a good bet. I think half pot is a fine size. So I think this is a good strong bet fold that, you know, it's a simple hand and it's a bit elementary, but I do think it's instructive and I think it was played properly. But again, I could be wrong.
Well, I think you make a good and an interesting case for betting the turn. And again, this is me just kind of trying to apply like general poker theory or hold'em strategy to Omaha. But you know, generally, you're assuming that you should have a bluffing range here, and I don't see any reason why you shouldn't. Like, so we should sometimes bluff here on the turn. Like, it's not obvious that Villain is just always calling.
Yeah.
I don't know that he exactly caps his range by not raising the flop, but I imagine like some of the hands that would make a full house on the turn would raise the flop. So, you know, it's not like he's just going to have absurd numbers of full houses in his calling range. Like, he probably has a lot of one pair hands in his calling range. Again, coming to that point about it's a little bit harder in 08 to hit high card boards than hit low card boards. Like, he has a little bit more incentive to peel the flop with, I don't know, something like ace, queen, 3-4, or I don't know, maybe that's a three betting hand, but you know, like a kind of hand that's like middle pair plus backdoor low draw. Like, that seems like the sort of hand that might be a little more tempted to peel here than, you know, maybe sometimes you wouldn't be peeling with middle pair in Omaha, but here it seems like the kind of situation where someone very well might.
Yeah.
Even a king doesn't have an easy decision, I think, if you bet the turn.
Yeah. That's right.
Or, you know, it's not just it's only a bluff catcher, I think. So, you know, you are in a position to put your opponent to a decision with a decent chunk of his range. I don't imagine he's going to fold an eight, but he probably has a lot of, you know, just king X or queen X. And likewise, if he does have some sort of high card hand, if he has something like queen jack 10X, the fact that there's a pair on the board is going to make him value his straight draw somewhat less as well.
Yeah,
I would think.
Yeah, I think I certainly think you can fold those hands. I also think you make a nice point about that we should consider what hands Villain would 3-bet before the flop. And from how my correspondent described this hand, I would imagine that this person wasn't 3-betting a lot. So like maybe ace-queen 4-3 is a 3-betting hand, but I imagine that a lot of those hands are not getting 3-bet in these games, which leaves Villain, I think, with a lot more ace-queen, ace-king type hands for high, which would also, that's a very attractive bluff target, I think. I think that hand is not going to want to call the turn, and I definitely think that a hand like queen-jack-10 might call, but will very, very often fold, and against a value-heavy range should fold.
So, I mean, once we've established that there should be a bluffing range, you know, we kind of want to think about how to build that out. And you know, often you're going to draw your bluffs, you know, like semi-bluffs, you know, draws tend to be pretty good bluffing hands. And the reason why they wouldn't be is that in situations where there's a danger of being raised and you don't want to be bet folding equity. So I think the point that you made about it was just so much of Villain's raising range is going to be full houses that Hero really won't be folding a lot of equity if he's raised. I think that actually makes betting more appealing. You know, you can look at this and say, oh, I have a draw. I don't want to get raised because I'll have to fold my draw. And I mean, in some sense, you don't want to get raised. But the reason you don't want to get raised really is because it will mean your opponent has a full house. But that full house isn't going to go away if you bet. And what you really don't want is you don't want to fold away a lot of equity. So you don't want to get raised by a bluff and, you know, be caused to fold either the best hand or at least a very strong draw. And you don't want to be raised by a strong made hand that you have a lot of equity against. However, getting raised by a range that it basically has you drawing dead, and then you just fold, you know, all that you've lost is the size of your bet. And you know, given that we do have reason to think that Villain is going to have a folding range as well, you know, it seems like having a hand that is live against his calling range and dead against his raising range, and also has little chance of winning unimproved, that sounds like a pretty perfect bluffing hand to me.
Yeah, and it's I think that's right. And and I also think that a lot of what you say is, you know, a lot of the ways that you build out your ranges in Hold'em, you're also going to build those out in Omaha. One problem is that there are just so many more combinations that it's very hard to get exact or to feel like you're getting close to an optimum. But I think this hand is a fantastic bluffing candidate. And I think there's money to be made in high-low games by doing what people did to beat Hold'em games a while ago, and you know, finding good barrel spots when other people are just trying to make a hand and pair up.
So do we have action for the villain?
Villain folds.
Okay, so you're
yeah. So there's no yeah, very simple hand, just a raise and a c-bet and a turn half pot barrel, but I thought it was instructive and I was happy to get the hand.
Yeah, I mean that's really the most important thing to get from, I mean, for, I would think anyway, for if we're discussing non-hold'em strategy, is sort of how to handle the more bread and butter situations, and you know, how to think about things like what your bluffing range should look like. You know, I guess there's some sort of voyeuristic reason why people might just enjoy like talking about big pots from non-hold'em games, but I think from a strategy point of view, thinking about pretty basic things like what kinds of hands good for bluffing is pretty important.
Yeah, and getting the fundamentals right. Like, I mean, you want to play well in big pots. That's where a lot of your money comes from, but you aren't really going to know how to play correctly unless you know what the fundamentals of your strategy look like. Like, you won't know whether to call it off unless you know you know, how big your value range is and how many value hands you're going to have, etc. So that's that hand. Do you have hands?
I do, but we also have a hand that was sent to us by a reader. And I actually think the sort of bigger question that he's asking is more interesting than the hand itself.
Fantastic.
So this is also from Bovada, actually. This is from a 1-2 no limit 6-max game. And the hero says, I have $221 after posting the big blind. So here's in the big blind here. Action folds to the button, who opens to $6. The small blind calls, and our hero is in the big blind with pocket aces. He re-raises to $24. And he says, I want to build a pot with a strong hand, and being out of position, I feel like I have to play a little stronger. So that's why I pot it instead of a smaller raise. So I think like re-raising is pretty uncontroversial. I actually don't think sizing is a super important issue here. I wouldn't go any smaller than this. I mean, like he kind of seems to imply that this is like on the big side. I actually think I could see raising as large as 30 in this situation. Okay. But I think like anywhere from 24 to 30 is kind of the sweet spot here.
Yeah, can I lob in a public service announcement here? A lot of people, especially people who read a lot about poker in like 2011, are thinking, and I don't mean this disparagingly, I'm one of these people too, right? There is a lot of small three betting going on these days, but there are two things to note about this. First is that a lot of the small three bets happen in position. Thing number two is that a lot of these really small three bets are probably incorrect, and just sort of like follow Ed Miller on Twitter if you want arguments to this effect. So don't feel guilty about making a big three bet before the flop, like sizing your three bets for pot. It's often fine, especially in cash games and not tournaments, especially when you're out of position, and especially if you actually want to price some things out. In general, three bet sizing is very important, and it's very complicated. And it's an interesting sort of trend in the email that we get that a lot of people sometimes seem apologetic for potting it. I think that I, too, would not want to go smaller than 24. I think 24 is A-okay. So there you go. End of PSA.
So far, so good. The button calls, the small blind folds, and we go to the flop. The correspondent says $54 in the pot. I would think after rake it might be more like 50, but regardless. We go to the flop, and the flop is queen of diamonds, jack of hearts, eight of spades. We don't have suits on here as aces, but I think given that it's a rainbow flop, it's not terribly relevant. And he says, the correspondent, by the way, is also named Nate. So Nate, but not our co-host Nate. Nate says, this is where I'm not sure on my thought process. There are a lot of hands that can raise call pre that hit a piece of this. Ace king has draws, ace queen hits, king 10, king queen, etc. I'm really only scared of queens or tens, as I'm not so sure queen 10 is in his range. I want to charge for draws and gain value on his value hands that I beat. And being out of position again, I feel the need to play hard. I bet 54, the button jams and has me covered, which means there's 307 in the pot, and I have 145, giving me almost exactly 2-1. I'd like to say that I did some deep analysis and made a great decision. Honestly, I think I was a little stubborn and didn't even think about it too much. I did believe I was ahead, but I should have thought longer. I ended up calling. I was right, but probably not by any skill level on my part. The villain had Jack 10 for bottom pair and a gut shot. He hit his 10 on the river to win the pot. I'm not trying to be results oriented. I wanted a call from that part of his range, but it stung. Would you have gotten away from it? So the answer to the most literal question here is no. I think when you see the flop, especially in a game where, you know, I would think the 1-2 game on Bovada is people are probably a little bit on the loose side or like a little too willing. So like, I think it's pretty bad for Villain to stack off with the hand that he stacked off with here. I think even calling the 3-bet with it if it wasn't suited is pretty questionable. But so I mean, I think people probably are going to be a little on the like loose and splashy side. So I think when you see the flop, even though you're right that this is not a great flop for aces, when you see the flop with a stack to pot ratio of less than 4, you really shouldn't be thinking in terms of, you know, getting away from your hand, at least not on the flop. I can imagine, you know, certain turn cards are very bad for you, and maybe if the turn is like a 10 or a 9, you might end up not putting your stack in. But if you have the opportunity to put your stack in on this flop, I think you're probably going to want to do that. And yeah, certainly there are hands that you're behind. You have outs against most of those hands. And there are also hands that you're ahead of. So, I mean, it's just one of those spots where, like, you know, you don't have 100% equity, but I think you have enough, you have presumably enough to get it in.
I don't think I'm stepping on your toes here. I like this spot because I think it's sort of cute from a theoretical perspective. Also, what I like about it is that your opponent can't really have you beat, can't really have a lot of value combinations without also having a lot of semi-bluffing combinations. So either on the one hand, your opponent's playing like a very tight and proper 3-betting range, and especially probably a range where he's 4-betting queens and jacks sometimes, and in that case, he doesn't have that many combos of hands that beat you. On the other hand, if he's playing like wider, it's not a case where it comes like 9-8-7 all clubs, then there are lots of different kinds of ranges that can have a good piece against you or have aces in trouble. In this case, it's very hard for there to be a lot of combinations in Villain's range that beat you unless he has a lot of two-pair combinations. But if he has a lot of two-pair combinations, like if he has Jack-8, he's probably going to have Queen-9 also, or Jack-9 or Jack-10 or Queen-10 and all that. Like, he can't have two-pair without having all those other hands unless he has an extremely eccentric playing style where he plays Queen-8 and not Queen-9 and Queen-10, which he doesn't. So just from that point of view, if you're beaten more than a little bit, then the potential bluffing part of Villain's range gets very, very large too. So that's another reason why I would not be getting away from aces here. But go ahead.
So the kind of broader point that I want to make, though, is that you don't necessarily have to – I mean, it's great if you're in a position where you can make predictions that you're comfortable with about how your opponent is going to play various types of hands, and you can kind of see everything that we just spelled out and can say, like, okay, we could have all these different types of hands, and I think he'll call with these and be willing to stack off and with enough that I'm willing to get it. Like, if you can predict how your opponent is going to play, which you often can when you're playing against weaker opponents, then, you know, by all means, you should do that. But I think that you also wouldn't be in a position where you're writing us with this hand if that's the case. So I think something that's worth thinking about is what incentive are you giving your opponent to put the money in with hands that are worse than yours? In other words, like, certainly it's not inconceivable that Villain has here a set of queens, a set of jacks, a set of eights, 9-10 suited, queen jack suited. Like, there are plenty of hands that aces are behind that, and all those could very plausibly be in Villain's range, and I think it's quite unreasonable to expect that he would fold any of those, and probably he would raise most of them. So we know that there are hands that are better than aces that are out there, and there's really nothing we can do about that. Now, look, the question is, if we're going to bet here, obviously we want to get action from the hands that are worse than aces also. If, you know, we know that those better hands are out there, so in order to make a bet profitable, we have to also, you know, make sure that Villain is willing to put money into the pot with hands that are weaker than ours. And again, like, if you can just predict that he will, then that's great. However, you can also think about, is there any reason why your opponent should be willing to stick money in? So it worked out well. In some sense, it didn't work out well for the hero that the Villain was willing to stick it in there with Jack 10 because he got there. But it's the kind of hand that you would like your opponent to put money in the pot with. And even more so, you'd like him to do it with something like King Queen or King Jack that has even fewer outs against you than Jack 10 does. So the question now is, why should Villain continue here with a hand like Jack 10? My suspicion, kind of based on the way this email is written, is that our hero will very rarely be bluffing in this situation, right? That his pre-flop re-raising range is probably quite narrow, and then his range for betting full pot, especially on this particular flop, which is, you know, as much as we've talked about how it's good for the Villain's range, I would say probably even better for hero's range. Queens and jacks are somewhat more squarely in the hero's range. Aces and kings are in the hero's range. So This is a range that hits you extremely well. And to be honest, I think if I were your opponent, I would feel somewhat comfortable folding king-queen when you pot the flop. And that's because I feel comfortable making these assumptions that you're not going to be bluffing here very often. So if you don't feel comfortable guessing how your opponent is going to play, I think the alternative to that is to think about trying to play in a way that gives him incentive to do the things that you would like him to do. So if you would never bluff here for full pot, and I would suggest that that's kind of an excessive amount for hands, like if you're going to bet fold, then you might consider betting less than pot. It's something that I hear a lot, this idea of like, I want to play strong, or I need to like be strong, or I don't want to be too weak. And I think, you know, those, I mean, I kind of know what people mean when they say that, but at the same time, those aren't concepts, like strong and weak aren't concepts that translate directly into making or not making money. Like there's no money that's paid to you for being strong and no money that you lose by being weak. So you might want to think a little bit more about how exactly it is that you are going to make money with this hand. And if you want your opponent to continue with hands like king-queen, then you might want to think about, how can I plausibly represent a hand that is not as strong as aces? What are some hands that I could have in this particular spot that are not aces? Ace-king is one that comes to mind as a hand that even a tighter player would probably re-raise and then could potentially be a bluff or semi-bluff on this board. So you might want to think about, well, how would I play ace-king? And then if you play aces in the same way, now your opponent has some incentive to continue with hands like king-queen, because if he folds king-queen, now he's making a mistake against your ace-king. So if you play ace-king and aces in the same way here, then you're giving your opponent a decision. If you do something like this that I kind of suspect you would only do if you had a hand like aces, then you're really just hoping that your opponent makes a mistake against your range, and you know, you may not have reason to think he's going to make that mistake. So you're kind of in a game now where you're trying to like predict how your opponent is going to play, which again is great if you feel comfortable doing that, but I the sense I get here is that you don't.
Amen. Nice speech. well done. Good. So thank you for writing in. Can I say, other people, you should also write in podcast@thinkingpoker.net. And something we haven't said for a while, if you are listening on iTunes, rating and reviewing us would help us a lot. I think we haven't said that for over a year now, maybe 2 years, but it would in fact help. So, if you like the show, if you're in a position to rate us on iTunes, it would be cool if you did that. And if not, thanks for listening anyway.
All right, so I'll share with you, Nate, a hand from WCoop.
Yeah, I'm coming into this one cold, so yeah, if I don't sound very smart, that's why.
I'm going to post it into chat.
All right.
And I really just want to talk about the river. I mean, we can talk a little bit about before the river, but I think the river is where things start to get interesting.
Sounds good.
So I'm going to delete the river action and then send it to you.
Nice. Good. Keep me way in the dark. Keep me way in the dark.
You might want to copy and paste that into a Word document, actually, because the formatting is kind of crappy.
I've got it. It's funny because I record out of a closet, so now I'm literally and metaphorically in the dark here.
So this is from a $1,000 Six Max tournament. I think we are not yet in the money, but we're probably getting somewhat close. I have 63 big blinds, which I imagine is probably about an average stack. I don't really remember, but just looking at the other stacks on my table, it seems like most other people have about 60, and there's one player who has 90. It's a tough table. It's generally a tough field. This is a 1K online tournament, and we're somewhat deep into it now. So although there were some weaker players who might have satellited in or whatever, many of them have been eliminated, especially in a six-max tournament. It's a little harder, I think, for the weaker players to advance. So, you know, the table is not particularly soft, and I don't expect a lot of really easy money going forward, which I think is an important thing to keep in mind. The under-the-gun player opens for 2.19 big blinds. The blinds are 8,000 and 16,000, which means that he's raising to 35,040, but it's a little bit over a min raise, like a 2.2x raise. So he under-the-gun opens for 35K, and it folds to me in the big blind with Jack-9 suited. I don't think this is really remotely close. I think you just call here pretty much always. I would absolutely never fold. You can probably make a case for three betting, but I think this is just going to play well as a call.
Yeah, I think you can do anything you want that isn't folding or raising.
There are certain people raising that could be good against, but I think it would have to be an exploitive thing. I think just generally, and I mean, playing out of the big blind is kind of a unique situation. I've seen some people taking some interesting strategies just since I've been playing out here the last couple of days for dealing with this, because unlike in other seats at the table, calling is very often an attractive proposition with some hands that from other seats at the table you wouldn't really consider calling with, but could like suited connectors or like a suited gapper like this is a hand. You know, Jack nine suited is not often a hand that's good enough to call a raise if you're kind of cold calling with people left stacked behind you, and especially if stacks aren't terribly deep. Which I mean, they're kind of deep for a tournament, but they're not deep in like an absolute sense. But you know, here from the big blind, your calling is clearly much better than folding. So when you're thinking about re-raising, you're not really thinking about, well, I could either re-raise or fold. You're thinking I could either re-raise or call. And calling, you know, unlike folding, is not a zero EV option. So the fact that you have a pretty profitable option to call means that you often don't want to three bet hands like this. And so generally, when you're playing from the big blind, your three betting range is going to be somewhat more polarized than it would be from other seats. And that's, I think, even more true when you're dealing with an under-the-gun raiser. So I think that there's really not a lot of reason to 3-bet hands like this. I think you kind of want to 3-bet more premium stuff and more junky stuff that maybe is not good enough to call or is just barely good enough to call. And this I think, is just a very clearly profitable call.
I agree. And you absolutely smashed the flop.
So the flop is King-Jack-3 with a club. I have Jack-9 of clubs, meaning that I have middle pair with a bad kicker and a backdoor flush draw.
This is an Omaha. That's smashing the flop.
I check. My opponent bets 2.4 big blinds into a pot of 5.5 big blinds, so he's betting a little less than half the pot. I once again think there's really no option but calling here. Given the price I'm getting, it's far too good of a price to even think about. I mean, I think I'm ahead more than half the time. Like, there's no question of folding, but at the same time, I don't think I'm going to be in good shape against his range for calling a raise. I have a little bit of interest in raising to protect my hand, but not that much, really. There's not a lot of awful turn cards. Like, you know, aces and queens are somewhat bad turn cards for me, but you know, a queen does give me a gut shot. One quarter of the aces and queens in the deck are going to give me a flush draw. And, you know, there's more cards that aren't an ace or a queen than there are that are an ace and a queen. So, yeah, I don't think there's a lot of, like, protection merit in raising. The hand is really not strong enough to raise just for value. So I think this is quite a straightforward call on the flop.
I agree. And the turn is a very interesting card.
The turn brings the ace of clubs. I think this is a card that although it's kind of a good card for me in the sense that it gives me a flush draw. Yeah, an ace is not the card I was rooting. Even the ace of clubs is not the turn card I was rooting for. I think it's a card that's definitely better for villain's range than it is for my hand, and probably better for his range than for my range. So I think this is going to be another pretty straightforward check and call on the turn. There's an outside chance I would fold if he made some really big bet, but I think against any normal size bet, what I have here is just a pretty good bluff catching hand, right? I still beat most, if not all, of his bluffs. I doubt he would turn a hand better than mine into a bluff. And I've got equity against the top of his range in the form of my flush draw.
Yeah, I agree. I think if he's got value every time that he bets the turn, then you can fold, but that's not going to be the case. I also think that although this card helps his range more than your range, I think people sometimes underestimate how much an ace can help a defender's range. And I do think you don't have to worry too much about this card just letting his range, you know, just really make life hard for you. So I think you're fine. I think this is a very straightforward check call, as you described.
I don't get the opportunity to call, though, because my opponent checks behind. Maybe we should talk about that for a second. What effect do you think that has on his range, his declining to bet? So the board now is ace, king, jack, three with two clubs, and he raised under the gun. He at a six-handed table, or five-handed table, actually. He raised under the gun. He bet the flop, and now he checked back an ace.
I think it caps his range. That's one obvious thing to say about somebody checking the turn in this spot. I think it may also take some pure air out of his range. I think in a tournament, when that card hits the turn, although, as I just said, that card does help your range, it'll make it a little bit harder for him to give up with 8-6 of hearts, which is pure nothing here. So it may also cap the bottom of his range a little bit. I think he'll have a lot of one pair much of which beats you, but much of which does not beat you. That's a.
So you think he's going to bet like pocket sevens on the flop?
I mean, I'm not sure he'll bet it on the flop, but I mean, I do think, but that's one pair, right? I think a lot of the hands that he'll have are one pair. Among hands that he bets the flop with, I think the pure air will be tempted to barrel here. It won't always barrel, but it'll be tempted.
Well, no, but I'm addressing your comment about him having one pair hands that I'm ahead of.
Yeah, I think some players will bet sevens on the flop. I think some players, like, I think if he had a worse jack than you, like, he might raise some of those hands before the flop, and he'll have reason to bet some of them on the flop. Yeah, maybe it's tough for him to have. Maybe it's tough for him to have pocket sevens. Yeah, no, you make a good point. I think better players will check behind there sometimes, but I also think that some players will want to fold out ace high and will be happy to realize their equity immediately. And I think that some players will make bad continuation bets sometimes with one pair. I think every so often people do play poorly. So I think that's possible. I think you're right that when I answered your question, I overstated the chances that he has one pair that is not as good as your one pair. But I think it'll happen sometimes.
I'm not sure what to think about him having air here. I mean, I'm inclined to say that a better player, I really don't think it's a good idea to just barrel a complete air ball like 8-6. I mean, even betting it on the flop, I think, is a little questionable. I think double barreling 8-6 of hearts here is not going to be profitable against me, which isn't to say people wouldn't try to do it. But, you know, I don't think the ace is actually that bad of a card for me. I mean, I might not even 3-bet ace-queen all the time pre-flop. I definitely have ace-10 in my range as a hand that I'm going to check call the flop with. Ace-jack is in my range. Ace-king could occasionally be in my range, although that is one that I would 3-bet pretty frequently. Ace-3 will be in my range. Queen-10 will be in my range. So there's a fair number of hands that I can have that are improved by that ace. I mean, I still have a lot of, you know, jack-x, king-x hands that don't like seeing that ace. So I mean, he does have some incentive to bluff here, but I don't think it's a card where he can just, you know, go wild and assume that it's massively better for him than it is for me. So I think that he can check back a fair bit of air here, or I think that he should. I think he has incentive to check back a fair bit of air. You're right that some people are overly aggressive about it, but I can see him. I think you also might be underestimating just how much air he could have based on the. I mean, he's essentially in the hijack when he's opening, so like I think he can have a lot of stuff that has no piece of this board whatsoever, and he may not bet all of it on the flop, but I think even of the air that he bets on the flop, I don't think it's a guarantee that he's going to barrel this turn.
I see. Do you think he's opening like queen six suited?
I would not be shocked.
Okay, queen six offsuit?
I would be much more surprised to see queen six offsuit.
Okay, so it's really a good sort of loosey-goosey range. Like, it's somebody who thinks he can win the pot a lot. Yeah, that's fair. I like everything you just said.
So it goes check-check on the turn, and the river brings the seven of spades. So the final pot is, well, that's not the final pot necessarily, but the pot at the moment on the river is 10.33 big blinds. The effective stacks are still like 55. Do you see any reason for me to bet here?
I think betting is a good idea if...
Let me remind people, the final board is ace, king, jack, 3-7 with two clubs. I have jack, 9 of clubs, so I had a flush draw on the turn that did not get there on the river.
So, do you think... I think this might not be the case for you. Jack, 9 might be near the bottom of your range. Is that possible? Or is it like... What about like 5-3 suited? Is that more like the bottom of your range?
Yeah, I think I have some 3x in my range. I think 10-9 will be in my range as well.
Okay.
That's a little more dicey because you're kind of the wrong end of a gut shot that, you know, the top end of it is like fully in his range. So like hitting a queen when you have 10-9 is it's not the nuts in a major way.
I would think of 10-9 as more of a raising hand than a calling one, but sometimes, I mean, it depends on a lot of things, So you have maybe some 10-9, maybe some queen 9. What would you do with queen 9?
Yeah, queen 9 is a better floating hand than 10-9 is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I would really have a raising range on the flop at all. I mean, I don't have kings or jacks in my range, so you know it would have to be like pocket threes and king jack are kind of the top of my range here. So I'm not going to do a lot of raising on this flop. It's also not a flop where protection is a real big deal. You know, I don't think my check call on the flop casts me very much at all.
Okay, good. So I could imagine different answers to that question. That would leave Jack 9 nearer the bottom of your range, in which case I might consider bluffing with it or betting. I think you're going to want to value bet some hands here, and I think an opponent could fold a better hand than Jack 9 here, but I think probably that won't happen often enough, and you will get to realize your equity often enough if you check that I would check this hand.
Yeah, I think if villain has queens, I think he'll fold that. I think if he has queen jack, he'll fold that. I mean, I could probably choose a bet size that might give him a decision with a king. But I think in general, if anything, people probably tend to pay off a little more than they should with a king, just because they kind of get that psychological attachment where they have top pair on the flop, and then they don't really appreciate how much the ace improves them and me, so that on the river they still kind of think like, well, I induced a bluff, so I should peel. I mean, I think in reality, like, even calling a 2/3 pot bet with a king here might well be a mistake, but I don't have a lot of confidence that I'm going to get somebody to fold it to a reasonably sized bet. I definitely think my hand is too strong to turn into like an overbet.
Okay, well then, if that's given what you just said, then for the love of God, do not bet your hand on this river.
Yeah, so it was one of the things where like I didn't feel great about where my hand sat relative to his like pair range. I think I'm in pretty bad shape. As I was saying, I don't really see him betting like lower pairs on the flop, but I do think he has enough air in his range that I can check, and he may bluff with it, but that's not really a reason for me to bet, I don't think. I think I can check, and at least sometimes he's going to check behind when he has nothing, and I'll win. I think, sometimes, occasionally, he'll check behind with something like a worse jack, or he paired the seven or something like that, and he'll check back, and I'll win. So, I think it's not entirely impossible that he lets me win at showdown when I check, which makes me not really want to bluff with my hand, especially given that it's going to be somewhat dicey to make him fold better.
Yeah, good.
So I check. And he bets 4.65 big blind, so he's betting 4.65 into 10.33. I'm holding Jack 9 on Ace King Jack 3-7.
Yeah, and you both have about 55 big blinds behind going correct into the river, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. That's tricky. So, given what you've just said about your range, I'm not sure Jack 9 is going to be a profitable call. I imagine the choice here is between check raising as a bluff and folding. I would probably fold, but in part because I'm not sure I block a lot of nut hands, and because I'm in a tournament and would be a little bit risk averse. So I think I would just check fold here, but maybe that's weak, and maybe I'm totally off base. What do you think?
Well, I did check raise.
All right.
I think you're right that the options are raise or fold. I think even though, I was saying he does have some hands he could bluff with here, I think that this, I guess, is getting a little into exploitive territory, but he's betting less than half the pot here. I think it's a tricky sort of opponent who does this very often as a bluff. I do actually think it's a pretty decent way to play a hand with like really no showdown value, like a 5-4 suited kind of hand, which by the way might well barrel a gut shot on the turn. But if he has like maybe 6-5 suited, just like some hand that can't even beat like an air ball from me.
Yeah.
He has some incentive to make a small bluff, but I think he's going to have a lot of value in his range, as he should when he bets small. And although he can turn some air into a bluff, I wasn't really expecting him to bet all of his air, which is part of the reason why I didn't. Well, part of the reason why I was checking my hand is that I did think sometimes he was going to let me show it down. So I think, although he's betting here, I think I'm a little too far down in my range to call. I mean, I think he can probably value bet a lot of kings here. Like, I see no reason why he wouldn't bet, like, king-queen or king-ten even in the spot. So I think there's quite a few hands that beat me. So even if he is doing some bluffing, I'm still not sure that I can call profitably. In terms of how well I block nut combos, I remember thinking in game that I was like, well, I block ace jack and king jack and pocket jacks. But realistically, I think he's probably betting most of those on the turn. I think you're right that he's capping his range pretty hard when he checks behind the turn. He really doesn't have a lot of incentive to slow play there. I think, you know, pocket aces maybe is the most plausible strong hand that he might check behind on the turn. I think king jack and probably ace jack are betting pretty frequently. So I think I might actually be off about how well I'm blocking his value betting range, although that was a big part of my thinking on turning this into a bluff in the first place.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I think I'd rather bluff with other hands, but I also really like your point that, especially given the psychology of how he's likely to respond to that, and even more especially given how many kings he was likely to bet on the river, I think this is a good spot to see a range that is both capped and big. that's a range that's wearing a target on its back, which is a sort of bad metaphor, but there you go.
I do think there's two other considerations here. One is that a lot of my hands that you might think of as being better for check raise bluffing are hands that I would have just bet the river with as a bluff. You remember we talked about whether I should bluff with this hand on the river, and I was saying I think it's a little too high up in my range, and I do have some weaker stuff that I could bluff with. So if I have no pair or if I have a pair of threes, those I think are hands where I'm just going to bet the river.
Yeah.
So I think this is actually probably the bottom of my checking range on the river, which is an incentive. Like if I have a king, that's going to make a better bluff catcher because now I'm blocking some of his value hands. If I have an ace, I'm certainly calling with that. So, you know, in terms of like hands that I would check with, this is pretty close to the bottom of my range. And the main reason I wanted to talk about this hand is to make that point. You know, I think a lot of people tend not to think about, like, this just seems like a spot where people don't really think about having a bluffing range at all.
Yeah.
You know, they just see that they have a pair and then they decide their decision is between calling versus folding. And they don't really think about the fact that although they might want to check raise some strong hands here, although some people might not do that either. I mean, I actually think it's a little obvious to me that he's going to bet the river a lot when checked to, just because I think he can check back even some ace X on the turn. And then I think he's definitely checking back like king queen and will probably try to value bet that on the river when checked to. So I think there's a lot of good reasons for me to check again if I have a hand like queen 10 and try to go for a check raise with it. So maybe if you're just not checking hands like that, you don't really need to worry about having a check raise bluffing range here. But I think that a lot of people don't even think about what their bluffing range would look like in some situations. And this is a good example of if you don't think about it, you won't see it.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to jump out at you in the same. Like when you have a missed draw, it's obvious that if you're going to win the pot, you have to do it by bluffing. And it's kind of obvious that that might be the bottom of your range. I think it's less obvious in situations like this where I've kind of already sliced the bottom of my range off by checking. Like I would have bet weaker hands than this. So I'm getting to the river and I don't think my hand is quite good enough to call with. Maybe I'm not really blocking much in his value range, but that's not essential for hand to be a bluff. Like
that's if right.
I don't have a better bluffing candidate than this.
Sure.
And you know, I also, like, part of it too is that he can be bluffing here. And even though I don't think he's doing it quite often enough for me to call, it does contribute to the profitability of my raise. Like, not only can I get him maybe to fold King X, but I can also get him to fold those bluffs. So, you know, given that my options are between folding or raising, if I fold, those bluffs win the pot. Yeah. So even though, you know, in some sense I'm talking about raising him off of a hand worse than mine, it's a hand that's going to win the pot if I don't raise. So it does contribute to the profitability of my raise.
Yep. I like it. So did it work? I'm really curious here.
It did work. I popped it about 3x. So he bet 4.65 and I made it 14.46. I guess I can tell you the exact amount if I switch over my
We've been talking about big blinds the whole hand. Nobody will know what it means. we're all thinking in big blinds by now anyway. Don't worry about it.
He bet 74.4 and I raised to 231.4.
Okay, it's not, you know what? I said that was really dramatic. Thanks for that was very exciting.
And he tanked for a little bit and folded.
Nice hand. Good. So good luck at the rest of the W Coupe.
Thank you. I've one kind of final point that I want to make, because I've been doing a lot of sort of like experimental stuff. Like, I don't know if it's exactly experimental, but like as much as I hope I just made a pretty convincing argument for doing this, I'm not 100% certain that this was correct.
Sure.
So I've been doing a lot of like somewhat experimental things, or like things that I wasn't doing the last time I played online 6 months ago. And you know, part of that has been like the stuff that I've studied in the time since then and what I've been thinking about since then. And you know, often it's things like this, you know, trying to develop a bluffing range in situations where I didn't previously have one, and being more experimental with sizing and stuff like that. And this was either something where I came across a good play or something where I made a bad play that worked. And you know, there definitely have been alternatives. You know, there have been times also where I've done stuff that I ended up regretting, or you know, when I look at it, you know, sometimes immediately after I did it, I was like, oh, that was boneheaded. And I think that you kind of have to be willing to take those chances a little bit. And you know, my hope is that even though I'm making some mistakes as a result of being experimental, like I'm overall making more money by doing slightly unconventional things than I am by just kind of playing whatever my game was 6 months ago, or a year ago more so. Like I had a very good, I had a very high cashing rate in the previous year's WCUP, but and I am kind of playing a little bit differently than I was at that time. But you know, I have to assume my opponents are too. It's been a year, and so I think that like being willing to kind of try new things or step outside of your comfort zone and accept that some mistakes are going to happen along the way. And this may well have been a mistake that just worked out for me. But I think you kind of have to accept that that's going to happen if you want to continue to improve and stay ahead of your opponents. Like you have to, you know, part of playing well is accepting that sometimes you're going to try to do something that turns out to be a mistake in retrospect, and kind of in the same way that bad beats are something that you just have to accept as part of the game. I think that mistakes are also something that you have to accept as kind of the price of playing well or trying to play well.
I completely agree. And, you know, you sometimes hear people say like, oh, this player is supposed to be so good, but I just saw him do this. And it's like, yes. Well, like that, the willingness to make a mistake is a big part of why like the person is so good. I also think it has this sort of collateral effect of getting you out of your comfort zone. And it's, if you're willing to make mistakes, you're also willing to depart from rote play, which has all these other like amazing benefits in your game. It'll help you learn. It'll keep you sharp. It'll keep you from making all sorts of calling mistakes, all sorts of folding mistakes. And it's just a really great side effect of making mistakes and being willing to make mistakes that you're also going to avoid a lot of routine and very bad play.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, it's not just our comfort zone we're outside of. Like, he's probably not real accustomed to getting check raised small in this situation.
Yeah,
And he's getting good. He's getting 2-1 on a call on the river, and I need the play to work about it just about half the time. I'm risking almost exactly the pot when I make this raise. So you know, he's getting a pretty good price, but I imagine that he just like doesn't see this sort of thing very often, and I wouldn't be surprised if he overfolded as a result of that. You know, if he just decided like people just have it when they do this, which is true. Like I think a lot of people do just have it when they do this because they never ask themselves that question, what would my bluffing range be here? And you know, that's a more relevant question when you're playing an online 1K than it is when you're playing like 50 cent a dollar on Bovada. But I wouldn't rule out the importance. I know I've made this point on you know, the podcast and elsewhere as well, but it's important to me. Like I wouldn't rule out the importance of doing that at 50 cent a dollar on Bovada as well, like learning to ask yourself that question.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit like you know how on Jeopardy sometimes they put up categories, like it's supposed to be a very light joke where they're supposed to sound very hard, so the category will be something like 14th century architecture or something, and people are supposed to be afraid to select it, but like nobody else knows a lot about never mind that it's Jeopardy and half the answers are going to be things like gold and France anyway, even if that is the category, but like it's out of their comfort zone too. Just choose the damn category. It's not that hard. Yeah. I mean, yeah, whenever you're taking yourself, you're exactly right. Like when you're playing pots, like when you're in situations that you don't know a lot about, like very, very often it's the same on, you know, for your opponent, and you're probably more prepared than he is.
Right. And these guys, I mean, they played more hands in the last year than I did. Like yeah. That's pretty much like most of the people I'm playing against. That's a fact. You know, like I play live poker once or twice a week most of the time. So like sheer number of hands, I'm not ahead. I do think that I probably understand theory better than a lot of these folks, especially the tournament players. And I think like that's where I need to be finding my edge right now.
Yep. All right, so you know, nice hand, or at least nice approach. Whether or not the hand was good, I'm not sure, but yeah, you have me convinced. And good luck the rest of the tournament series.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.